Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Copla Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. If you are new to these dear shores that we call Copla Connections Isles, what we do here is we watch every single film in the collective Copla family filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time. We are here today for episode 65 on this specific journey, and the film we are discussing is the 1970 Daniel Haller film, The Dunwich Horror. And I'm joined by a return guest, somebody who has been very impactful and important for this here podcast. It's the one and only Todd Jordan, who is kind of a multi-hyphenate musician, composer, writer, and podcaster, which was first and foremost how I got to know Todd way back when before this podcast started. It was the first podcast I ever listened to where I was like, hey, that's quote unquote a normal person doing this. It's a couple of guys with a mic recording a podcast, and I was kind of like, oh, I got inspired by that. I was like, they could do it, I can do it, surely. So it's great to have Todd back, seeing as he joined me really early on to discuss 8mm. So head on back and listen to that. So as always, guys, we'll be spoiling this film, but it is a lovely Yog-Scoff, H.P. Lovecraft bashing, but also understanding the work of the man at the same time. And yeah, we get all into it. We discuss everything we possibly can about it. We talk about Lovecraftian as a concept. We talk about the film. We talk about the career of Dean Stockwell. We talk about just all types of fun things. It's very sprawly. It's very weird. It's very fun. So yeah, all that's left to do is to get out your Necronomicon, put your hands by the side of your face and do that weird Aleister Crowley thing as we make some Copla connections with the Dunwich Horror. Rituals, Necronomicons, and Cthulhu is what we're in for in this episode as we look at the 1970 H.P. Lovecraft adaptation, The Dunwich Horror, directed by Daniel Haller and written by Curtis Hanson, 8 Mile's very own. Henry Rosenbaum as well, not anything to do with 8 Mile, and Ronald Siloski. The film stars Dean Stockwell, Sandra Dee, Ed Begley, Lloyd Bochner, and today's Copla connection in her second ever screen performance, Talia Coppola, as she is credited in this film, later known as Shia. Joining me to put the Coppola family up on the altar as we read passages from the Necronomicon and determine if they are pure or just beasts from another dimension is writer, composer, musician, and host of the Bitter End podcast, Todd Jordan. How are you, Todd?
I am dope as hell, Petros. Are you ready for the old ones to return? Yogg-Soth off.
Yogg-Soth off. I see. I'm glad that you said that right up front, because I was trying to like pass what they were actually saying, like front the first. Like, well, what is he? What's Dean Stockwell? What is sexy Dean Stockwell going on about in this film?
Do you know what? He's absolutely stunning as like a, just a 70s gent. Do you know that Dean Stockwell's dad was the voice of Prince Charming in the original Disney Sleeping
that's
Beauty?
So amazing.
And the genes run deep. That's just a voice. Imagine what he could have done with his face.
One of the things I was thinking about, when like we'll get on to Dean Stockwell, obviously, when we get really deep into the film. But at this point, I think he could have gone two ways. He could have become Dean Stockwell, or he could have been John Saxon. Like I was like they look similar, because obviously his character is basically terrorizing a woman called Nancy. I was like, it's not Dean Stockwell in Nightmare on Elm Street, is it? Then I was like, that would be great, because obviously one of the many films you've covered on Bitter End podcast is the, well, I say films, franchise.
We did the lot, baby.
So yeah, for listeners who may not know, obviously, of Bitter End, what is the Bitter End, and what do you guys do on that pod?
So the Bitter End podcast is a movie podcast in which myself and a cool dude called Tom pick a franchise, and we start it from the beginning, and then we see it through to the bitter end. So we're talking 12 Friday the 13th movies. We're talking, oh gosh, maybe 8 to 10-ish Friday the 13th. We did Home Alone. We did Jaws. We've done Candyman, Highlander, Police Academy. That was maybe the roughest ride of all. And there's been some John Saxon along the way. There's been a lot of heavy hitters. Not many Coppolas that I can think of.
Well, there is one person who kind of really sticks out in the films that you've covered that kind of crops up in a Christopher Coppola film. So I'm not sure if you've ever seen the Nicolas Cage starring Deadfall. It's also got Michael Biehn in it. It's directed by Chris Coppola. Has a performance from the one and only Angus Scrimm.
From Phantasm, the tall man. I love Angus Scrimm, and it's so rare to see him in anything non-Phantasm related.
Yeah. Like, but he is absolutely cuckoo bananas in that film.
Of course.
Because he plays this kind of shadowy character who comes in.
Whoa, like, that sounds like a stretch for Angus Scrimm.
Like,
what?
Really late into the film, and he's like, he's got like a claw hand.
Does he go, boy?
He does no boy, but he kind of, there is, and I think there is like, in his office, he does have some like silver ball. It's like, all right, we get it, Chris Coppola. You've seen Phantasm.
Oh, what a great treat. I might actually have to, I've not seen that one, so I'm going to have to sneak it out, because I like to think that I'd seen pretty much everything that the Scrimster had done.
Yeah. I always remember listening to your podcast, and there's that great anecdote about Angus Scrimm, and obviously the people who knew him outside of his films like didn't know that he had that double life as a movie star, right?
Yeah, he was just a sweet old man that did like everybody's gardens in his neighborhood. And when he died, the whole neighborhood turned out to his funeral and discovered for the first time that he was one of the great horror movie villains of our age.
Amazing.
Never talked about it.
I recently had a discussion with my stepdad about like films, a rare kind, because normally if we talk about films, it's like war films, like last week's Pattern, for instance. We'll have a long discussion about that. But I was like, so are you into like any horror films or anything? And he's like, well, we had this long thing where he described the plot of a film, and it turned out to be, and now I'm going to forget what it is. Now it's,
try it on me, I might know. I like horror films.
It is a film about a haunted house, but they recreate the haunted house inside of a laboratory setting to see if the haunting is the house or if it is the person. It's a definite article film. It's the something.
The something. Okay. I can't.
We'll leave that thread hanging for you, listeners, and we'll get back to it once I've done a little Google. But yeah, and one of the films he said was, I really like Phantasm. Have you ever seen it? I was like, "Have I seen it, baby? I've seen all five of them." And he's like, "What? There's five?" So yeah, me and my stepdad, I think, are going to at some point do a basic like bitter end binge watch of the Phantasm sequels in one night.
Oh, mate, I would love to go back to those films. They're so strange and they're so weird. And a lot of them, especially the earlier ones, have some references to a certain Mr. H.P. Lovecraft, H.P. Lovey C., who we might be talking about a little bit tonight.
We're talking about H.P. Lovecraft quite a substantial amount. But before we get to H.P. Lovecraft, I must ask you, as I ask all my guests on this podcast, Todd, is when did you become aware of the Coplas? And I'm not just talking like the specific person, I want to know that, but when did you realize they were this kind of, I don't know, tentacles like Cthulhu of these tendrils that kind of go all over the place?
It's an interesting question. So I did, for my sins, do a film degree.
Mm-hmm.
I'd seen the big ones, you know, I'd seen all of the films that you need to see. I'd seen Pulp Fiction, thought it was fine. I'd seen Goodfellas, thought it was pretty good. I'd seen Eraserhead, liked Eraserhead. Those are all the films you need to see in order to go to film school. So off I went. And it's not until then that I turned up and I saw all three Godfather films in one sort of weekend, I think. Probably.
I was going to say, what, one sitting was going
to... Not one sitting. But me and my mates did it. And there was this other guy there who'd like been through the whole thing. And the whole way through, he was like, "Oh, that's his aunt, that's his sister, that's his brother, that's his nephew." And I was like, "Bloody hell, mate. All right, wind your neck in. You don't need to cast all of your friends and family." And then it was, I want to say, because of how old I am, almost assuredly the year that Lost in Translation came out.
Amazing.
And then there was this name again, Coppola. Yes. I was like, bloody hell. Why am I seeing this name all over the place? So that would have been when I was sort of suddenly aware.
Did you check out Lost in Translation off the back of... Obviously, watching The Godfather.
I did check it out. Now, brace yourself, Petros. That film is not for me. Do not fall off your chair. I saw it once in the cinema when it came out, and I left safe in the knowledge I never need to see that film again. I know a lot of people that love it. I had a big, long chat recently with one of my best friends about how it's his favorite film ever. I asked him why. He couldn't tell me. That's fine. I understand.
I think a lot of men who say that's their favorite film, all you need to do is Google image search the like vinyl like release of it, and that is why it's their favorite film. It's the opening shot, ladies and gentlemen, is why it is a lot of gentlemen's favorite film. Not my favorite film, but we're not here to talk about that right now. Have you ever met a Coppola?
Not that I know of, but like, how would I know?
Yeah, I get.
How would I know?
I don't know. Some of them, I think, would announce it. But
they've got like different names and things.
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
right.
But you'd know of Nicolas Cage. I think you'd smell Nicolas Cage before you saw him.
Absolutely. but like, I've met some men. I've met some women. Some of them might have been Coppolas.
That is true.
I don't know.
That is true. There's a lot of names on this list that I haven't even got to cover on this podcast because, quite frankly, nobody's ever heard of their films, so you could have met one of those. Who knows? So when it comes to the member we're talking about this week, which is Talia Shire, do you know what would have been your entry point? Would it have been the Godfather that you would have seen her in first?
I'm trying to think back. So I'm more familiar, and I'm going to do that really bad thing where people talk about a female artist and immediately start talking about their male partner.
Uh-huh.
Right. I'm not doing that deliberately, but this was my path in. She was married to David Shire, yep, who I know from his incredible music score work. I love film scores. And he's one of the best out there, specifically The Conversation, the Francis Ford Coppola Conversation. That's the one that sticks in my mind. So, for me, the path in was going, "Oh, she's married to David Shire. Cool." That for my sins, that was my entry point.
Yeah.
That said, I would have seen her obviously in The Godfather.
Yeah. Rocky, never seen the Rocky films?
I've seen the first one, not for me.
That's why it was never on the bitter end, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh God, not for Tom's wanting to try. Tom fucking loves Rocky. Tom gets up in the morning ready to talk about Rocky.
Yes, yes. Well,
sorry, Tom.
You need a super sub for that series, Tom. I'm your man. I love the Rocky films too. It's interesting that she's carried the name through, right? As well, I don't know.
I think she's probably technically a Schwartzman now, isn't she?
Yeah, but... yeah, yeah, or maybe back to I don't know. No, still Schwartzman. Yeah, her husband unfortunately passed away, but yeah, Schwartzman. I don't know. I don't know why the Shire. Why she went? I'll take that one.
I guess maybe that's when she like registered. Well, no. Because you have to register for your like card, don't you?
Screen Actors Guild, yeah.
So maybe that's it. But I got to say, she's got some chops. You know, we're not necessarily going to get to see the full display of her chops in 1970 in this movie we're going to be talking about later. Mm-hmm. But like my terrible story of like only knowing about her from her husband is not meant to reflect on her like talent as an actor. I think she's dope as hell.
Yeah, well, like when you get to like something like Godfather Part 3, because obviously you lose Robert Duvall in that film.
Mm.
You kind of see that she gets to pick up the mantle of this kind of conciliary for Michael and really gets to like, I don't know, some really meaty stuff to do. Despite that film kind of not being, well, it's not as bad as everyone says it is, but at the same time.
I like it.
Yeah, I like Number 3. It's got fantastic sequences, that whole sequence in the opera at the end. And especially her, speaking of Talia Shire's acting, her kind of like knowing that like there's the poison.
The poison cannoli. Yeah.
And she's like, just the face acting is perfect. And well, yeah, seeing as we're talking about great face acting, let's talk about film we are here to talk about, which is The Dunwich Horror. But before we do, let's listen to the trailer.
The nights are darker. And night is when it happens in The Dunwich Horror. Come back, old one. Princes of darkness. Repossess the earth. The Dunwich Horror, based on H.P. Lovecraft's terrifying tale of those who explore the unspeakable. Starring Sandra Dee, Dean Stockwell, Academy Award winner Ed Begley, Sam Jaffe. Believes the history of horrendipity written here. The love story of a girl looking to the future and a boy dedicated to the mysteries of the past. He invokes the unspeakable.
Yeah, Satha.
She invites it.
You're one of us now.
Deathless paradise of terror, where fear eternal lives. And the dead come to life.
I've never heard anything like that.
The Dunwich Horror was released on the 14th of January 1970 on a budget of... nobody knows, because it's not available on the internet, and made $1 million, which I imagine for the Roger Corman outfit American Pictures International was probably gangbusters profit, because I think they were knocking out films for like 75 grand, or he would be like, here's a budget for one film, go make two on the same sets, please. I know that that's basically what he did with Francis Ford Coppola with Dementia 13 in 1963. So it's kind of great that there's this, I don't know, relationship, yeah, that the breeding ground, and I'm sure it's something we can get into, this kind of great breeding ground that Roger Corman created for going forward some of the most interesting directors we get, right, for the next 30, 40, 50 plus years of cinema. But I must ask you, Todd, what is the Dunwich Horror all about? Could you give us a brief synopsis?
Yeah, man, that would be my pleasure. straight off the bat, I would like to discuss the controversy of Dunwich versus Dunwich.
Okay.
So we're two British men. I would say medium British, medium rare British.
Yes, yeah. I got a bit of Greek in me.
Right, of course. No, I would never have guessed Petros Tassilidis. But before you saw this movie, if you'd seen the name written down, how would you have said the title?
I don't know, just because I think I've always heard it as Dunwich, just because I think the first time I heard it pronounced is from an American talking about the H.P. Lovecraft works.
Of course. Okay. So I come from the school of Norwich and things of that nature. Yeah. So I had read the H.P. Lovecraft story as a teenager, loved it. I'm well aware of the controversies, of all of the problems with H.P. Lovecraft as a human being. Can I swear on this podcast?
Of course you fucking can.
Massive piece of shit.
Yep.
Not here to defend that. As a teenager, I didn't know about that. I didn't know it at the time. Sorry. I read the stories. I really liked them. And so in my head, it was always Dunwich.
Yeah.
So I always find it very shocking when I come to this now and they say Dunwich.
Yeah, well, I guess it's that thing of like, and sorry, American listeners, they just don't know how to pronounce things a lot of the time. All right, sorry guys, you don't. We've all seen your musical artists come over here and play Gladstonebury. Like, come on, guys. Yeah, I think that own, like, weirdly, because I'm not that versed in the works of H.P. Lovecraft, but I remember when, again, talking of pieces of shit, Richard Stanley made Colour Out of Space. And there was talks once that was semi-successful that they were going to, Spectrevision were going to allow him to do like a planned like trilogy, not like linked within characters and stuff like that, but H.P. Lovecraft stories. And one of them was going to be, Dunwich Horror. And I think I would have heard on a podcast or some kind of news segment that's how it was pronounced. And yeah, I always find like that is a fascinating thing, because we can get into thoughts on Colour Out of Space, because it's interesting. There is connective tissue within these films. Both of them involve somebody shooting something in a barn, ladies and gentlemen. That is a connection we can make between those two films. So,
I didn't do the synopsis, did I? I should do that now. I tried to get out of it because it's a tricky one to do a synopsis for. I guess what you're talking about is apropos, though, because a lot of H.P. Lovecraft's stories do have interconnective tissues. He was kind of writing a sort of a shared universe, loosely called the Cthulhu mythos, is what it was referred to. Although he himself, as a writer in the 1920s, he didn't like the term Cthulhu mythos, which is what his friends and other fellow writers were calling it. He wanted to call it Yog-Sothothery.
Okay.
Yog-Sothoth being a primary element in the story that I will recount to you now.
Amazing.
So in a sort of a timeless time, I guess, vaguely, I mean, the movie's made in 1970. Everybody in it kind of looks a little bit more, there's a sort of a 1920s/1950s thing going on.
Yeah, you don't know. Yeah, because they're supposed to be like country bumpkins as well.
Yeah. So. They've got cars. We know they've got cars and coffee shops, but they also dress like sort of Victorian gentlemen, and there's a lot of weird like timelessness going on. But the movie begins with a woman giving birth while some sort of freaky old people watch her when they've got like markings on their foreheads with sort of arcane imagery and impossible geometry, and they're sort of watching and, you know, they're fans. There's cool flute music. And then we get one of the all-time dope as hell animated title sequences. Yeah. If you listening to this podcast, if you don't have time to watch the Dunwich Horror, at least look up the animated title sequence, because it's so cool, isn't it?
It is. I have got a lot of time for, and the song as well. The score for this is composed by Christopher Holmes. And it's just, I don't know, it's got like almost that thing that they would do with like giallo scores, right? Where it would be like, there's like an orchestral element to it, but then all of a sudden there's like a rock beat underneath and stuff like that. Like, I left the blue, like Arrow Blu-ray playing, and it's kind of got just a, I don't know, 16 bar loop of like the music from this film. And I was just like, found myself, I was like, yeah, I'm just jamming out to this, baby. Come
it's
on, Christopher
really
Holmes.
Strong. It's really good. So I don't know how much detail you want me to go into this, but our key players are Sandra Dee, of the yes. song from Grease fame.
Yeah, that's all I, like, look at me, I'm Sandra Dee is all I think of. I've no idea of any of her other
So
films.
The other lyrics are, look at me, I'm Sandra Dee, lousy with virginity. In this movie, she has so much sex.
but has virginity. And we'll get on to how much sex she has later on in the podcast, because I've got a burning question. I'm gonna pin that onto the board now so I don't forget it.
So what happens after the birth and the animated title sequence is that we see Sandra Dee as Nancy walking around the Miskatonic University in the fictional county of Arkham, Massachusetts, where most of H.P. Lovecraft's work was set. And she's just sort of having a bit of bants with Dr. Henry Armitage about the Necronomicon.
Yeah, that is a big sticking point for me. That's just the fact to like, this is a book for a lot of people, obviously, you might not know H.P. Lovecraft work. You just think of immediately like Evil Dead and stuff like that, right? Like
of course, and that's what they were referencing when they made the Evil Dead. They were referencing these stories, but there's a lot. It shows up in a lot of his work. This fictive book of the dead called the Necronomicon, written by the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred, supposed to be the book of dead names is what the word Necronomicon means.
Amazing.
And it's all about sort of lost, it's supposedly written in a language that is long since lost to time. Nobody on earth speaks that language anymore. And there's all of the unknown secrets. A lot of H.P. Lovecraft's work, and I would like to again remind listeners that I do not endorse the man at all. I know that he's an absolute, absolute monster. But a lot of his work has this idea that is reasonably appealing to me, that is, there is this sort of, it's a hidden world that's just beneath the surface, that's slightly out of reach, but it's always there. You could just, if you could just scratch just a little bit deeper, you can get to this thing that you're missing out on that will solve all of your problems. And the sort of recurrent idea time and time again is the danger of too much knowledge and the fact that ignorance is bliss, but that is human nature, is to like push away from that and, you know, strive for things that we shouldn't. And that is all embodied within the pages of the Necronomicon.
Conveniently written in English, though.
In this, apparently written in English, yes. So Sandra Dee takes it to the library. Matey boy, Dean Stockwell, aka Al from Quantum Leap, also in Blue Velvet. He's the suave guy.
Yeah, he sings a song, right?
In Blue Velvet. Sings Candy Colored Clown, they call the Sandman.
He's sexy as well. He's very, very sexy in this film.
Now, interestingly, in the original Lovecraft story, the Dean Stockwell character of Wilbur Whateley is a disgusting, disfigured goat boy who's sort of half human, half goat, has a hunchback and kind of shuffles along in this like dirty mac and creeps through the shadows, and you can smell him before you see him, and he's this sort of horrific figure. Whereas in this, he is slick and smooth and a handsome man.
Well, yeah, because you've got to imagine this film would have been what, made in like 1969. So they're kind of very much kind of imbuing that whole like, I don't know, he's got that hippie edge to him where he's like, even without the kind of magic that he's obviously wielding within this film, he's just got this kind of like thing where he can stare at you and it's like you will succumb to his will. It's like, even I found myself, I was like, I think I'm going to get pregnant, like just looking at Dean Stockwell.
He's a handsome fellow. And there's some very, very cool sort of nice, like, it's the, you know, it's just after the Summer of Love. That's very much the vibe here. So I'm sure I'm going into too much detail, but basically, Wilbur Whately, Dean Stockwell, he wants the Necronomicon. His great-grandfather once had another copy of it, but was hung by the locals in the village of Dunwich for you know, reading from it, was involved maybe with the sacrifice of a young lady.
Yeah. You kind of, you don't get to find, yeah, he tells that story later on in the film, right? We get that, and it seems to be, once a generation, somebody's trying to bring back the old ones,
the elder things. So yes, that is the nature of what's going on here, is that just as I've described with the core nugget of the Lovecraft oeuvre, is that long before there were humans, there was another race entirely, the old, sometimes called the old ones, the elder things, all of this stuff. They were here before us and they either went away or died or moved through to another plane of existence or something. And for reasons that Lovecraft does not care to explain, Wilbur Whately wants them back.
Well, yeah, isn't there like this whole thing, and it's a thing that works literally as in like in literature, not as in like an American thing, like literally, is that there's like with Color Out of Space, like it's described as like it is a color that no human can.
Right, so it's
there's a lot of stuff in H.P. Lovecraft, right, that is like that, like it's a dimension that can words cannot fathom, like.
Absolutely, so it's aspects of sensation and experience beyond the realm of the human senses. So a lot of the same ideas are present in Clive Barker's Hellraiser, for example, which is a very Lovecraftian story. But there's this this notion that, you know, we're dumb animals on a cosmic sense, you know, within the wider universe. And we know that there are colors that we can't see, and, you know, temperatures that we cannot withstand, and sounds that are so great that they will make our ears bleed, and ideas supposedly within this world that if you were to get the idea in your head, your brain will explode and things like that. And for whatever reason, the Whately family, or some members of the Whately family, they're like, no, we need progress. We need to push this on. We need to usher in the new realm. We will adapt, but we've need it. And it's, I guess I struggle with it a bit because it's two ideas, right? Because partly it's like progress, we push it on. It's time, we need to evolve. Yeah, we need to like change what we can experience and go to these new heights, these new realms. But at the same time, he's literally trying to bring back something called the old ones.
Yeah.
So it's very backwards leaning as well.
I guess it's that thing where he's trying to look for something that is like, it's new to our existence here. Do you know what I mean? And like, I think this film, and it's something that I guess young people throw around this word a lot and kind of like films for it. It's a vibe to this film. It doesn't really care too much about like, the story, like you're saying, there is no reason given why Wilbur Whately
wants to do this. We have to wonder. It is by its own nature unknowable. So as the movie progresses, it's basically about this struggle with Dean Stockwell, who's Wilbur Whately, and he needs to get the Necronomicon. But he doesn't just need the Necronomicon, mate. He also needs Sandra Dee to be pregnant and in his house, which he manages to engineer by getting her to give him a lift home and then messing up her car so she can't leave, and then having sex with her a bunch after having drugged her tea. Not cool.
Yeah, yeah, and like being half scared to death by Alan Jaffe as this as old. I think his credit in the film is just like old man Whateley.
Old man Whateley, yeah. And so that's what the movie sort of becomes. Is he effectively keeps her captive, sort of in his house. She's there willingly though, but he is drugging her tea. And he, just as we've sort of described with this like Lovecraftian idea, he opens her up to new realms of experience and pleasure. He, they have a lot of chats about sex, and he's like, "Do you like sex?" And she's like, "It's fine." And he's like, "But do you love it?" And then there's a lot of some very, very cool 1970 trippy dream sequences with naked people running around in the hills and like some cool, like sort of early digital Technicolor graphic effects.
Yeah, stuff. That's amazing, that stuff. Like, and it's a nice little shortcut for like getting around stuff, right? With that whole thing of like,
you can't see it. You can't see it. Yeah, it's unknowable.
Yeah, yeah, it's unknowable. You cannot see this beast. Like, it's nothing to do with the budget. It's nothing to do with the budget.
Which I've got to say pays off particularly well once we get to the big twist that Wilbur Whateley has a secret brother living in the attic.
Oh, yeah. I was like, where is this? Where is it? And immediately, seeing as like this was a first time watch for me, like, and yeah, that was going to be my, like, When did you first watch this adaptation of this story?
I would have first seen it probably a couple of years ago, but I'd read the story when I was a teenager, so a long, long time ago. So I already knew about the hidden brother.
Well, it's really interesting, like something like this, because then I start to realize films I'd seen earlier, but obviously came out after this, and like even with the story are probably, I don't know, maybe borrowing from this or just like kind of tropes you see throughout horror. But there's a shot that is like, I think it's the same shot just reused in this film of the door rattling or in the like kind of third floor of the house. And just the shot of the door weirdly was reminding me of the film The House of the Devil, the Ty West film.
I love that film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like kind of, again, that's like kind of period set in the 70s. And it just immediately brought my mind to that, where I'm like, oh, as soon as somebody says like, you cannot go in there, or like, oh, what if she goes in that room? I was like, oh, like, it's going to be really bad.
It's Bluebeard's Bride, isn't it? It's, yes, the folktale of Bluebeard's, yeah, Bride, the young woman who marries and...
Don't go in that room.
You must never go in that room. And traditionally that story ends, she goes in the room and discovers all of the dead brides that have come before, yeah, her. In this, Sandra Dee does not go in the room. She's very pliant. Again, she has been drugged. This is kind of why, but she's just like, yeah, okay, fine, I won't. But what we do get is sort of a plucky Girl Friday type who's trying to find Sandra, yeah, Dee and be like, I want to bring her back. She goes looking. She goes snooping. She pushes past old man Whateley, who's like, don't go up there. I'm very old. She pushes past him. She goes up and she has the coolest moment in the entire movie, which it's very dated. But my God, I love this scene. Her death, yeah, when she opens the door and discovers Wilbur Whateley's twin brother, who looks more like their father than Wilbur Whateley does. And their father, spoiler alert, their father is Yog-Sothoth, old one from, okay, Beyond the Stars. The mighty Yog-Sothoth, of Yog-Sothothery fame, who in this movie is represented by like some color and the sound of some flapping wings and like kind of tentacles, but also it's like a ring of teeth and these just sort of flailing.
Yes.
Good Lord, it's good. I mean, if you want to talk about like an unknowable horror, something that you can't, like, we're not equipped to glimpse it, the way that it's handled, chef's kiss.
Do you think that like H.P. Lovecraft lends itself to like low budget horror? Because I imagine this would have been done on a low budget, because I guess you can go two ways with it, right? When you start to like envision the characters. Like, I'm not sure if you ever watched the TV series Lovecraft Country.
I did.
That,
yes,
was kind
I did.
Of like, yeah, like based on, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that was based on a novel that was by Matt Ruff that was like a sort of a reaction against, that was more of a reaction against H.P. Lovecraft, the man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But then obviously used his characters and some of them followed the Yogs of Offery. But like with that, obviously they go kind of full digital, all these creature effects and stuff like that. But then you go to like, there is something, especially within the writing, there is the unknowable and the idea that you can, I don't know, like, and tapping into that horror of like what we don't see is more horrifying.
Yeah, right? It is a bit more literary, like you were saying. So one of my favorite kind of quintessential moments from any of those stories is in the short story, The Call of Cthulhu, uh-huh. which you may have heard of. There's a moment in that where there's like a new dimension is being summoned up out of the sea and it's merging with the earth. And there's all of these sailors that they're kind of caught underneath this dimension as it's coming up like an island, and there's just a line where there's a man falls into an angle that shouldn't have been there. And I when I was a kid reading that story, I was like, that is the creepiest idea ever, that there could just be like an angle that shouldn't exist and you can fall and get trapped into it, like getting your foot stuck in a grate or something. But you cannot put that on film. The closest that I've seen is there's, you mentioned The Color Out of Space earlier, much, much earlier than the Richard Stanley one, there's a German movie called Die Farbe, which translates as The Color. And they did an adaptation of The Color Out of Space. It's the same story. And the way that they handled it was they shot it. It's all in black and white, except for the color, which is the only thing Amazing. In the film that is in color. And it's, you just get these like spots on the screen that are just like these really, really bright Technicolor That's patches amazing. While the whole rest of the world is black and white. That's a cool way to handle it. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, no, I think it's fundamentally just very, very difficult to put into pictures and sounds, right? That's kind of the point.
Yeah, and like, how well that you'll be able to speak to this more than I will. How much does this stick to the actual story of?
Oh my god! I mean, like in a cursory mode only.
they glanced at the book and went, "We'll do something."
So the ideas are there. They mash up a lot of it with like Aleister Crowley and his writing. So there's a lot like Lovecraft stuff that doesn't really reference like God or the devil or anything like that, because it's like, it's beyond that. It's just like, oh, there's aliens and it's all of these things that were here before us. And it's just like, you know, it's nothing to do with any of that. Whereas in this movie, it relies a little bit more on sort of satanic imagery and things like that. Things more earthly, you know, but there's nothing cosmic about it. Like I said, Dean Stockwell's character is like very suave and sexy.
Yeah.
There's no sex in Lovecraft.
He's almost like he's got like that charismatic cult leader vibe to him. Do you know what I mean? Like you could see him seducing people into like following him and kind of having this kind of like cult of Cthulhu. Almost.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they're basically just asking him to do like a young Aleister Crowley who you know, was, well, not so much in his later life, but was a sexy dude, as, you know, as from what I've heard. So it doesn't really stick to it that closely. It's a very cool story. It ends up with like this big sort of climactic battle on the hill where Wilbur Whately, Dean Stockwell, is trying to sacrifice Sandra D to bring back the old ones, and his twin brother, whose name I don't think we learn.
Never learn it.
He's like escaped and he's rampaging through the forest. And again, he's just like some colors and some flapping wings. Oh, the flapping wings thing is kind of a cool idea. This comes up a lot in the film. It's something from the story is about whippoorwills, the birds.
Yeah, the birds, right? Yeah. Anytime someone dies, there's like this kind of, like, it's the sound design on it is like, it just sounds like, it's like they're saying birds. I'm like, is that someone just crumpling paper? Yeah. What is that going on?
So that is something from the story where there's local lore that whippoorwills, the birds, are what will carry your soul away after you've died.
That's a cool idea.
Which I think is called a psychopomp. I think that's the word for something that is like a ferryman between here and there. I've probably got that slightly wrong. But they are these psychopomp figures, and that every time the locals are like, oh, you hear a whippoorwill call and it means that someone's died and that they're coming to like take their soul. And so that's a really nice, unnecessary, I would say, touch that in this movie they have that as an element. And when the granddad dies, they're like, oh, the birds are coming to get him and stuff like that. They didn't need to put that in.
And we get it again right with Wilbur's mum. And there is some great stuff. There's some great kind of lines in this film. Like when we first meet Lavinia, who is Wilbur's mum, they're like, well, obviously we see her giving birth, but then we like, it's like Armitage by the local doctor, who obviously in his kind of fact-finding mission is trying to like, he's going to the like the guy off the general store being like, what do you know about Wilbur Waitley? And he's like, well, you need to speak to a doctor. And he's like, oh, so go to the doctor. Speaks to the doctor. He's like, It was the grandfather who delivered the boy, not I. So he goes to speak to him, and then when he goes to the asylum to meet Lavinia, I think it's him. They say either the doctor or one of the orderly. He goes, "You wouldn't believe it, but she's only 45."
This is a cool element, yeah. And we see her, and she's sort of this haggard, grey haired. Yeah. I mean, haggard. I'm being mean to the actor, but like the point is, she's not 45, right?
Yeah, it's like this kind of hagsploitation like character on screen.
And I think it's the in the story again, she's a bit more like in on it. She wants. So the point is that the baby daddy is Yog-Sothoth from beyond. And so she has somehow, through the use of the Necronomicon, she has mated with this like impossible, unknowable being from beyond the void, with the idea being that one of their children will then be able to bring the dad back to our dimension. And going through this process has obviously taken its toll, on her. So she's been able to produce the two children, but she's like never the same again.
Well, you'll be able to answer this more than I will, because I actually don't know the answer. So hopefully you may know it. Is the character of Lavinia, obviously that is a character name we get in Colour Out of Space. That's one of the daughters of the family. Is that Richard Stanley in his adaptation making a reference to the wider universe of H.P. Lovecraft?
It's been a really long time since I've read Colour Out of Space. Now, Lovecraft did reuse a lot of names, especially because some of them were like quite regional Massachusetts names. Uh-huh. And so there would always be these names. Also, I think he maybe met two women in his entire life. If one of them was called Lavinia, he would have just used that name again and again.
Yeah, because obviously we talked about that planned Richard Stanley trilogy. I think Dunwich Horror would have been the final one in that.
I'd heard it was coming, yeah.
Yeah, in that trilogy. So, and there's kind of like, you almost get like groundwork with the character of Lavinia in that you could see her.
Oh, yeah.
Buying into, eventually, like fully buying into this cult-like thing kind of being into this thing of trying to summon the old ones and Yog-Sothoth's baby mama, essentially.
Yeah. When I watch films with my wife, any kind of film, whenever there's like the baddies are on there and they're explaining their plan, her thing, one of her like classic lines, is she always says, why would you bother being evil? like why would you do it? Like the things that they're trying to do are never worth it and never work out. And she's just like, I don't know why you'd bother being evil. Uh-huh. And I think one of the things that's quite appealing to me within these types of stories is the baddies aren't, I don't know how evil they are. They're just, I don't know. They're just poking their noses where they shouldn't belong. Which I think is kind of human nature.
Well, I think there's that element, and like I think Colour Out of Space is a great like counterpoint to that, because there almost isn't like an evil. Do you know what I mean? There's like
a colour can't be evil.
A colour can't be evil, and it's like there's
except for maybe like purple.
There's magenta. Yeah, I think it's magenta in that film.
Evilest colour.
No thanks, Barbie. But I think it's a good kind of device to tap into this inherent evil of man, right? That like, I think that's what's kind of fascinating, especially with the two H.P. Lovecraft adaptations I've seen is it's.
Oh, mate, you haven't seen From Beyond?
No, I've never seen From Beyond.
I don't think it's got any Coppolas in it, but you got to watch From Beyond. Stuart Gordon, which again is this idea with that. There's a dude invents a machine called the Tillinghast Resonator.
Uh-huh.
And when he turns the machine on, you can see the other dimension that exists on top of ours at all times. It's always there, but you can't see it until you turn on this machine. But when you turn on the machine, they can see you too.
Oh, shit.
And spoiler alert, the things that live in that other dimension, they're not friendly, but there's also this weird extra element that hanging out with them is like kind of addictive. And people keep turning the machine on because they're like, no, I need more. I need to know. I need to see what else is there. It's like a recurring theme within this type of story.
Well, I think when we look at kind of H.P. Lovecraft, even inspired work, like you mentioned Hellraiser earlier, they're good ways to create an allegorical stories for other things, right? Like in the way that like Hellraiser is essentially like it could be a thing on addiction, like that kind of, and like you're saying with From Beyond, it is that thing of like people get addicted to this, like, so that's something that is essentially going to kill them.
Or even just the pursuit of knowledge. Like another one that it's not necessarily talked about that often as being a Lovecraftian story, but I would class it as is like something like The Fly, for example, where a man is like destroyed by his own pursuit of this scientific thing. There's no sort of magic in it. None of these stories have magic in it. I mean, even in the Dunwich horror, it's not within the fiction of that film. It's not magic, it's science. It's that's the way that the universe is.
Yeah, it's kind of it's fascinating because I don't know, and it's got me thinking, you mentioning The Fly, it's we're giving the man credit here, and again, we must stress H.P. Lovecraft himself, but his writing, is that essentially what creates like gloopy body horror in some way?
What you've touched on something there that I think is worth mentioning, that like, you know, he wanted to call it Yog-Sothothery. The reason it's called, his body of work is called the Cthulhu Mythos, is that after his death and long until the present day, other writers have continued to work within that same realm, and a lot of the ideas and things that show up in stuff that's called Lovecraftian or Cthulhu Mythos work is actually from a plethora of other writers, who some of whom maybe weren't enormous assholes, but like you know, so we can't give the bad man the entirety of the credit for delving into this space and creating things like body horror that we're talking about, because I don't think there's that much of that in his work. But the people that it did inspire, you know, some of who, for example, the writer of Lovecraft Country, things like that. There is a lot of cool, interesting stuff in there. You know, it's an interesting scab to pick at, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great jumping off point. And it is interesting as well that, like, what would you say, and I'm always fascinated by this, like, what is the definition of Lovecraftian? Like, it's a word that's bound, like, any, do you know what I mean? Like, you hear, oh, anything's a bit weird. It's like, oh, it's very Lynchian. It's like, is it? It's just a bit confusing. Like, it seems to be a kind of a shortcut to like that doesn't really go anywhere. But what would you describe as like Lovecraftian?
To my mind, it's generally about someone trying to solve a mystery that involves supernatural elements that aren't magical. It's kind of where like science overlaps with philosophy and will definitely get you killed. I mean, I might as well say to you, dude, what is the definition of Coppolian?
Like Coppola is a director. So if we look at Francis, for instance, somebody who's just worked in multiple different genres, and do you know what I mean? Like, you look at just kind of his big hitters, The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, The Conversation, and Bram Stoker's Dracula, for instance. Different stories completely. I guess the key theme in Coppola's work, and I would say is kind of, and I think it goes through to Sophia as well, is family. And I guess that is really defined with his kind of big breakout with The Godfather. But then he kind of ditches that with The Conversation immediately. And then, but in a lot of his later stuff, that is something that you look at The Outsiders and Rumblefish, like big in there and stuff like that. But I think that's like a tenement that he comes back to all the time. And then Sophia, like, as much as like found family and kind of trying to, I don't know, Lost in Translation, a film that you don't like. I think there is an element of like kind of, I don't know, trying to find this familial, some kind of relationship, and like whether it is, however you look at, because obviously when you're in a romantic relationship, I guess in the end you're, the end point can be creating a family. So I think family is what I would say is the kind of the Coppola thing. Then Nick kind of goes off into weird tendrils, and Jason Schwartzman is like, hey, I'll just play weird little guys you would like to punch in the face.
And what did you think of Talia Shire in The Dunwich Horror?
Oh, look at you doing my job, Todd. Well, I'll fire that right back at you in a second. But before we do, I wanted to ask you about like just some of the performances in general. And we'll kind of just go through some of the key players in this. So we've talked a little bit about Dean Stockwell. What do you think of his performance overall?
I think it's fan bloody tastic. He carries the movie for me. He's so good, isn't he? He does a really good job of doing this sort of like smoldering upper class, decayed upper class. So there's that word decadent. The original meaning of decadent means in decline or in decay. Mm-hmm. So that you have to kind of reach these great heights and then like fall from them to be like decadent. So people will talk about decadence, and sometimes nowadays people use it more as like just meaning luxury indulgence. But it's this idea of like, oh, you're losing your kind of your greatness and your wealth, and your, you know, if you keep on like that, you will be in the gutter. And he's got this thing, because he lives in this manky old house, but his clothes are really nice. And
it's like that old money British thing, right? Like people have got money, they'll live in these kind of dusty old manners, but they've got loads of money. It's kind of air of that. And obviously, like, is it like New England area?
It's like Massachusetts.
New England. Yeah, it's like where like the kind of, because there is this kind of, it has got those like cunt, yeah, like there is almost a Britishness to it in a weird way, where it could be these like old stately homes that they're living in. Yeah, I think Dean Stockwell's fantastic in this, and I've got to give a shout out to Richard C. Glauner, the cinematographer, because the way he shoots Dean Stockwell, because there's a lot of like these really great kind of like panning in shots a lot of the time, and we get these great like shots of like Dean Stockwell's eyes a lot of the time. And yeah, he really does carry the film, because you don't know how to feel about him throughout most of it. I don't know.
You do see him secretly drug Sandrine's tea.
That is true.
And then mess up the engine on her car so she cannot leave. Yeah. So I think it's pretty clear from the start that he's like a baddie, but he does it with this kind of quiet like panache.
Yeah, and there's like this thing of like, I don't know, like, and I think that is something that would be interesting to have taken out, do you know what I mean? Like, or even if they'd got like, it could have been him, but like just doing some insert shots of like hands, use that kind of play from the Giallo handbook of like
black,
like,
leather gloves.
And it's interesting we talk about that, because obviously this film at one point was going to be directed by Mario Bava,
who I love. Mario Bava, that would have been fantastic. I think the audio would have been quite bad if he had done it, but that was great. Can we talk about the amount of times that Dean Stockwell does the Aleister Crowley thumb thing?
Is that an Aleister Crowley thing?
I don't want to break the fourth wall, but for the listener, Petros, if you do a Google image search for Aleister Crowley, who was the kind of Satanist, occultist, writer, sexual deviant, drug pioneer from back in the day. If you scroll down through the photos of him, you will absolutely see somewhere, there we go, he's got like a big triangle on his head and he's got his fists on either side of his face with his thumbs poking out. And this is the thing that Dean Stockwell does throughout this movie.
Yeah.
When he has to say his magic words from the Necronomicon. Now, Petros, I'm from Brighton. You've been to Brighton, right?
Yes, I used to live there.
Did you know that Aleister Crowley was cremated in Brighton?
I do, yeah. So my old flatmate, and here's a tangent for you, had a lot of Aleister Crowley books.
Whoa.
Was a big fan. And I remember kind of seeing these books laying about and kind of like very interesting covers. Do you know what I mean? These kind of like pentagram-esque designs on the front. And like I do, I just went in this kind of like deep Google hole and like checking stuff out, watching YouTube videos, maybe listen to a couple of podcasts on him. And yeah, immediately I was like, oh, he's around there somewhere. Like, do you know what I mean?
His ashes got posted to America, apparently.
But like, they're still, like, some of them, when he got cremated, it's in the air, baby. It's in the soil.
Yeah. Somewhere, maybe one of those thumbs. But this is, so again, this is like a clear, clear reference. You know, anyone listening, look up this picture of Crowley where he's got a pyramid on his head. He's doing his thumbs all the way through this movie. Dean Stockwell's doing this whenever he's got to put on a robe and read from the Necronomicon and have some, like, some cosmic horror sex
happen. Yeah, so I think the next person to talk about is Sandra Dee. What did you make of her performance?
I mean, obviously, we've touched on that, you know, I know her name from the Grease song, but I'm not 100% sure I'd seen her before. I think it's cool. She's good. For dramatic purposes, it suffers from how like placid she is throughout. Yeah. And I think it's the thing that she's being drugged, right? She's being drugged. So whatever it is that Dean Stockwell's like, hey, we should do this. Let's go get naked in this field and then go do a ritual or whatever. She's kind of just like, yeah,
it's quite cool.
I'll bring some Twiglets. She's like fine with the whole thing, which means that she doesn't get to do like the horror scream queen thing of being like, no, I'm holding the door, grabbing the knife. You get away from me, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
You'll never do a Yog-Sothoth on me. She never gets to do that. So she's always just like, yeah, cool, sounds chill. Right up and down to the final ritual where she's like getting naked, lying down on the altar. He does the thing with the thumbs on his face again. And then it comes down to that musty old professor from the start of the movie, Ed Begley Sr. Has to come and fucking rescue her.
Even when he like comes and rescues her and like she's kind of out of the haze of Yog-Sothoth and like Wilbur's kind of control, she's very much like, oh, okay. Okay, and like he's apologizing to her, like, oh, I'm so sorry. It's like, oh, where's Wilbur gone? Oh, no. And it's like, I don't know. I think she has a bit of a thankless task. She does great with what she's given.
Yeah.
But I think she gets a bit of a thankless. She's just kind of docile and just like milling about. Whereas like her friend Elizabeth in the film kind of gets that thing of like going around the town like, what's happening with my friend? Like, what is going on? Like, she gets to do that kind of like crazed, like trying to uncover this like conspiracy that could be going on.
Yeah.
Whereas like Sandra Dee just kind of, yeah, like once she's drugged, it's like kind of, oh, it's, do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
it's like a flat line with a couple of boop occasionally. Like,
can we talk about the final shot of the movie that happens after she's been rescued? Do you have any thoughts on that?
What the? Well, it's got one thing I love in a film. It's got like a tiny firewalk in this film because Dean Stockwell basically bursts into flame and falls off a cliff, and then we get that shot. Oh, I know the shot you're talking of.
I'm talking about when it zooms in on her tummy. And we get a little x-ray and there's a little baby in there.
Yeah, well, this reminds me weirdly of, there is a later Talia Shire film called The Prophecy that is, no, sorry, no, there's no definite article to that form. It's just called
Prophecy.
Prophecy. Yes, The Prophecy is the Christopher Walken film.
That was the one I thought you meant.
Not that film. This is a John Frankenheimer 1979 film about a mutant bear in the woods, and it is fan-bloody-tastic. But that film ends with Talia Shire's character being pregnant, like on the same
kind of... Not from the bear.
No, but from her husband, but there is, like, it's kind of implied that, like, the mutation would happen because it's in the water.
Oh,
the water in that area is what it's making. It's a very weird ecological thriller. Kind of ecological horror. Listeners, go back in the archive. It's in there. A fantastic episode with Will Chich where we discussed that film. But yeah, it's got that same denouement. And like, it's done a lot funnier in this film because we get a kind of like, what would that be? Kind of like rear projection or like front projection of like a kind of baby in
like
utero.
A baby. Like from like a science
textbook.
Yeah, exactly. But it's interesting because so obviously the baddie, Wilbur, and his twin brother, they were twins whose dad was Yog-Sothoth. One of them looked more like the dad and was this horrible, unknowable, like killer flapping thing. The other one was sexy Dean Stockwell. So this baby in Sandra Dee is the grandchild of Yog-Sothoth.
Now
we can see from the little projection thing we're shown, looks more normal, right? No sort of weird alien baby-ness to it. Maybe that'll come out more in puberty. But like, in theory, this one, you know, seems a little bit more, if it's got the kind of the smarts of Wilbur and the power and otherworldliness of his brother, maybe this one will manage to do what Wilbur did not, right? I think that's the implication.
Is there a sequel? Is there a sequel story to... Does this story continue in H.P. Lovecraft's writing?
I'm trying to think. Like, you're putting me on the spot. There's a lot of people out there that will know so much more about this than me. I'm a bit of a dilettante. Yog-Sothoth shows up in other stories for sure. I don't know if there is... And probably the town of Dunwich shows up as well, or Dunwich, sorry.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a sort of a direct Dunwich horror to this time. It's personal.
Well, I think with this kind of reveal at the end as well, and like just from having a quick glance at Wikipedia, I hadn't put two and two together, but like this film was basically rushed into production. Because it had been kind of on the shelf since 1963, like kicking around the idea of Dunwich Horror, but was kind of, you can imagine it was like, kickstarted into production after the success of Rosemary's Baby.
That's what I thought,
yes. This is like, do you know what I mean? This is kind of like, and when you kind of look at it through that light, it's like, oh, yes. Like, even when you think of the kind of, even the dream sequences have got like that kind of, because I think there's moments in that and she's like on a jetty and stuff like that, right? And like, this is like in the, we can't go on a jetty, like bodies of water, a bit too expensive. We'll just do it in a field. We'll do a bed in a field. That's a bit more our speed. But like, it's kind of, that's fascinating. I'm not sure if I like the film less now that it is basically like a, what properties have we got knocking about? We've got Dunwich Horror. Can we make it a bit more Rosemary's Baby, please?
it's an interesting thought. I wasn't sure if it was just the time, just the gestalt of what was going on then, or, you know, it was a deliberate thing.
I would imagine with Roger Corman's kind of production company and the fact that they are such a, like a low budget outfit and kind of churning stuff out, they would be like, that's hot. Let's do something like that. Like, as you kind of see, they kind of like churn things out. But let's go back to the performances. We must talk about Talia Shire.
Of course.
Who has, she plays...
Nurse Cora.
Yeah, Nurse Cora. What did you think of her performance? Because she gets a couple of scenes.
She's
right?
Cool. Yeah. Look, man, we our couple of connections are slightly few and far between in this movie. I think she literally has three scenes. So she is the nurse that works for the doctor who delivered the Whateley children. When I guess our principal hero, the sort of crusty old doctor is, crusty old professor is in there talking to the doctor and getting all of the important information, supposedly. It cuts back to the women in the reception area, the nurse and his mate, and they're just like chatting about the town, and Cora is sort of casually chatting about the Whateleys, and she's like, oh, I wouldn't go to that house if I were you. That's when I was a kid, we always used to say that house was haunted. And you know what? I don't think they're alone up there. I think there's a third Whateley.
She gets that good night, that a good little kind of strong dun, dun, right? dun moment, and I was like, that's kind of, I like that more than the kind of, I don't know, it's almost like a kind of stuff that we get in the doctor's office with this. It's like that folklorish thing that, like, you hear about those houses growing up, especially like in suburbia. You're like, oh, I don't like that house. Like, there's crazy things going on in there, or like there's always stories. And I was like, oh, okay, she gets to do this kind of folklore exposition to some degree, but at least kind of filling in the blanks of who the Whateleys are. I was kind of, I was like, oh, good for Talia getting to do a bit of this.
And like, she does it well. Like, she kind of throws the line away. What I mean is, like, a deliberate choice as an actor. Like, she doesn't, like, labour the point. She doesn't underline it.
Yeah, yeah.
She, like, tosses it out, like, like, knowing its importance. It's very cool. So we get that. We get a second scene where the doctor has to suddenly leave to go and save the day, and she helps him put his coat on. Like, you know, cool. She's a jobbing actor. Do what you got to do. But that's the scene. And then there's a bit after that where she crashes her car and dies, right?
Well, she crashes her car and, like, gets out fine, even though it's kind of, like, gone into a fence. And then, like, walks through the woods, and it's the brother that gets her, right? It's the colour attacks her from nowhere, and she's dead, baby. She got a death, which is like, you've got to be, I don't know, you've got to be an important character, even though we see later on this film is like characters we've never seen before. It's just like, they just start getting killed at random.
But yeah.
She gets like a significant, she gets at least a scene out of it, right? She gets a car crash, and she's a solitary character. She's not just like the hordes of the town people who kind of are ready for a lynching of a Whateley, do you know what I mean? Like, she is just like, I don't know. And I think her death is, like Elizabeth's one, is sadder, because it's like, well, within the confines of this film, we have at least got to know this character somewhat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she was an innocent.
Yes. 100%. I'm just going to go through some of the things that are on my notes here. Some big questions I've got for you, Todd.
Hit me.
One of them, what did you think of the mustaches in this film?
They're strong. I guess they don't speak to me on a personal level. You know, I'm looking at you. I'm seeing a mustache staring back. I'm not going to say anything ill about mustaches.
No. Well, one thing I would say is, as a man who has got one that cannot come off, there is some hokey mustache work in this film. Dean Stockwell's is not real, right?
Oh, I see. I thought you were angling to it. Like, seriously, I was looking at you. There's this moustache there.
No.
I thought you were just being like, do you like moustaches or not?
No, come on, mate.
Do you like them or not? No. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to say anything bad about moustaches.
No. Say what you want about moustaches. Like, you know, there's bad moustaches in this film.
Okay, phew. Okay,
mine's
good.
Bad as well. I'm just... But mine's real. No, yeah, because Dean Stockwell's is quite... And then I realised quite near the end, and I wasn't sure whether it was fake to begin with and then real. Oh, no, real to begin with. Sorry, real to begin with and then fake. But the doctor, Dr. Corey, his mustache near the end, I'm like, did they need to, like, come back and do a shoot, like, a couple more days and he had shaved it off? Like,
I think the thing that you're not accounting for is the fact that his mustache grows in dimensions not capable of being seen by the human eye. So... it's actually very good.
And a big question I had with this film is Nancy shagged by the Necronomicon? We get a scene that she is up on the altar and Wilbur puts the Necronomicon between her legs, kind of using like her crotch as like a book, basically like a book stand. to read from it. And the scene continues, and we have Nancy like moaning in pleasure, and I'm like, is this the conception of the is the Necronomicon somehow like releasing the, I don't, is it Yogg-Saphoth? I was like, is it Wilbur's seed? Like, what is happening here?
Don't we see in the Evil Dead movies, in those films, the book has a mouth, right?
Yeah.
And a big old,
I'm not saying it literally. Is it like, is this kind of like, I don't know, it almost feels like this sexually charged sequence where, like,
yeah. I mean, maybe. we do know that by the end of the movie, she is pregnant, although I feel like that's probably from one of the earlier romps that she has with Wilbur. But it's possible. I think she just likes hearing the words more than anything. I think it's the words that bring, because Dean is reading from the book and doing the Aleister Crowley thumb head thing and saying Yogg-Saphoth a lot. I think that's what's having her like moan and be like, yeah, baby, testify, more than the book being between her legs. That's my personal view.
This is Lovecraftian erotica, baby. It's like, he's getting to the juicy stuff.
More love, less craft.
50 Shades of Magenta. So before we wrap up on this film, is there anything that we've kind of missed that you kind of wanted to shine a spotlight on, Todd?
That's a great question, and I'm definitely not stalling for time. No, man, we've covered it all. I mean, we've covered everything from impossible geometry to magenta and Sandra D. Like, what more is there to talk about?
Well, one thing that there is left to talk about in this podcast is, were there any Coppola connections in this film? And what I mean by that is there anyone in front of or behind the camera who has worked with the Coppolas elsewhere? Could you spot any, Todd? No worries if you can. You didn't, because you're looking at me very terrified right now.
I am absolutely drawing a blank, baby.
Well, I've got a couple for you. They're kind of, Dean Stockwell is a man who has worked with the Coppolas a handful of times.
Oh, whoa.
So he is in Roman Coppola's debut feature CQ as Dr. Ballard. He is in The Rainmaker as Judge Harvey, stepping back into Francis Ford Coppola's work. He's also Howard Hughes in Tucker, The Man and His Dreams.
Oh, wow.
And is Homer Thomas in Gardens of Stone, as well as being in Mr. Wrong, a film that is... cinematographer is John Schwartzman. So he's got a nice bit of Coppola credentials, has our good boy Dean Stockwell.
Wow, good for him.
Yeah. I like to think, because obviously CQ came after the run of films that Francis would have done with him, that like when it came to Roman, his son, doing his first feature, it's like, Dad, Could you ask Dean Stockwell if it'd be in my film, please? He asked exactly like that as well, like a Dickensian child.
Please, sir.
Please, sir, be in my film. That is it, because I guess with the time that this film came out, a lot of actors in this, like Ed Begley, for instance, this is basically one of his final roles. He died in 1970.
Yeah.
So a lot of the, Jaffe as well, like kind of a bit long in the tooth, and like you don't really, they're not spanning into the 80s and 90s, so they're not really, they're definitely not working with Sophia.
No.
So when we come to rating films on this podcast, Todd, I like to ask my guests, what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film? What would you pair with the Dunwich Horror?
I don't think it matters what the wine is, as long as it's spiked with psychedelics.
Oh, yeah.
Ideally, maybe like a nice chilled Lambrusco, something with a little bit of sparkling fizz to it.
Nice.
But that would be sort of the ideal. It's like either that or like, you know, Kool-Aid.
Yeah, And you have to chase it up with a good old hit of DMT.
Yeah.
to be taken into another plane of existence that you'll come back, try and explain, and people will be like, "You've gone mental, mate." I've got to agree with you there. I think, I don't know, there's a slight full-bodied, I don't know. I'm not going to try and... This is a hard one.
This wine is impossible to describe with human senses. Yeah, it's impossible to taste.
So, how much are we paying for this wine? Is it a bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf wine?
It's bottom shelf, but it'll mess you up. You can't pay more for this wine than Roger Corman would pay for an actor, right?
Yeah, I think this is this is like using this obviously loose analogy to talk about the film itself. I think this is kind of bottom shelf, but it's that great fun bottom shelf where you're like, I rated this on Letterboxd as 3 stars because I was like, do you know what? I had fun with my time with it. It has this vibe.
It's and a I'm kind pure of, vibe.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm here for that. I'm here for like sexy Dean Stockwell just kind of being moody and sinister. And just, I don't know, it does what it sets out to do, and it's a bit of fun. So yeah, this is bottom shelf, but... I don't know. It's teetering. Maybe it's middle shelf with a yellow sticker. So I must ask you, Todd, as we start to wrap things up, based on this film alone, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
Based on this film alone, I mean, it's hard to say because you can't give the Coppolas that much credit for this film alone, but it's pretty strong. So I would say... No.
That is absolutely fine. We win some, we lose some, okay? I would tell you what the running tally is, guys, but it's something that I forget to always keep track of, okay? So let me ask you 2 questions, Todd, before I let you out into the world.
Go ahead.
The first one being, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the entire filmographies of the rest of the family?
Ooh. What an incredible opportunity. I would keep Jason Schwartzman.
Would you care to expand on that? What is it about Jason Schwartzman's work? Why didn't you pick a Jason Schwartzman film?
I would keep him because I recently rewatched The Polka King.
Yes.
And I like that film. It's cute.
That is great. That is actually that is one yet to be covered on the podcast. Yeah. And I like... For somebody who I said earlier is like plays these characters that like 9 times out of 10 deserve a slap, and I don't mean that in like I think Jason Schwartzman's great, and it just happens to be those are a lot of his characters. I think when you start your career with Max Fisher, it's kind of you might have pigeoned yourself into this thing, and the fact that he looks like a perpetual child, it's like you want to slap him, but you don't, because it's like, oh, you look so sweet. Like, I can't. But yeah, Polka King, I think, is one of those rare instances where he plays just a nice guy, right?
Well, he's a nice guy who's completely in over his head because he's hitched his wagon to the wrong star.
Yeah.
So he's like he's gone ride or die for someone that he thinks is his mate, and he's not. The pitch that I would give to anyone who may or may not want to watch The Polka King is that there's a point in the movie where Jason Schwartzman's character has the opportunity to get whatever he wants. For the first time in his life, he's holding all the marbles. He can make an outrageous demand and get whatever he wants. And what he chooses is that he wants to be given the nickname Mickey Pizzazz.
That was literally on my mind. I was like, yeah, he's got a great name in that film. I was genuinely just thinking that. Like, Mickey Pizzazz is like exactly what I think about when I think of that film. Amazing. Jason Schwartzman, that's a good pick. See you later, Sophia. See you later, Francis. See you, Nicolas Cage. Bye. I must ask you this, possibly the most important question of the whole podcast. I know you don't like the film itself, but what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
I can only assume he says, I hope no one ever finds out what a domestically violent piece of shit I am. Please don't tell anyone. And she'd be like, yeah, okay, mate. Yeah, I definitely won't tell anyone. Wink.
Yeah. Don't listen to Seth Green, all right? I'd never throw him in a bin. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Or Gina Davis or anyone else that's ever encountered him being a huge piece of shit.
Yeah.
On Lovecraftian levels.
Yes. Yes.
That's what we can only assume.
Todd, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Where can people find yourself? Obviously, yeah, you make music, you write stories. Have you ever written anything Lovecraftian?
Tried to. You know what? It's quite hard. No, people can find me, I guess. Check out the Bitter End podcast. It's on all of your podcatcher vibes. If you like Caged In, then you'll like that, probably, maybe.
Well, yeah, I've got to say this, seeing as you are, like, people may not know this. I don't know if there's a change in the audio. I hope not. I hope they all sound as great as each other. But Todd is sat like a meter in front of me, which is rare in these times. Since the pandemic, we've all been doing this digitally. But Todd is here. So I can say this looking into his eyes. I should have said this up front as well, because now, like, statistically, people have dropped off by this point. But without the Bitter End, there probably is no Caged In, because I remember it was the first podcast I ever listened to, and this sounds damning with faint praise, and do not take it this way, is the fact that, like, it was the first podcast I listened to that was a truly indie podcast and was like, this is so great, maybe one day I can do something like that. And you know what, guys? Maybe in 5-10 years' time, I will hit that greatness.
Oh, mate, that means the world. Well, you've surpassed the greatness by an incredible mile. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you so much, Todd, for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Been my pleasure. Yog-Sothoth.
So there we have it, guys. The Dunwich Horror done and dusted. A massive thank you once again to Todd Jordan for joining me. Please do be sure to check out all of the things that Todd does, whether that is the Bitter End podcast, Rad Spurts, his amazing noise project that, it's a lot of fun. It's kind of like... It's kind of like industrial dance gym music. It's pretty mad. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes when I'm working out, I put on a bit of Rad Spurts and it kind of makes me feel anxious and energized, which is exactly how I like to feel when I am getting pumped, as it were. And thank you to you guys for listening. If you've seen the Dunwich Horror and you feel like we've done this film a disservice, or you agree with what we said, or if there's points in this film that we missed that you would like to carry on the conversation, you can do so by heading on over to all of the socials. So that is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok, all at Caged In Pod. I certainly would love to hear from you. Or you can drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. As for next week on the episode, well, that is a mystery, guys. Like the cosmos, like the book of the Necronomicon, like the movements of Cthulhu, you'll just have to listen in next week for another journey into the Coppola family tree. If you enjoyed this episode or any other episode of the podcast and would like to support what we do here over at Caged In, you bloody well can. You can head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod and give me some of your money. Or if you want to give me money and get something tangible that isn't my time and extra content, you can do so by heading on over to TeePublic. The link is in the description. Or you can head over to Etsy. I recommend US listeners hit the TeePublic. UK listeners hit the Etsy, just because shipping wise it works out better for you in the long run, and there's no shipping fees and import charges and all of that good stuff, and you get some amazing designs by the fantastic Tim Sinclair. That's all up on there, so help out, get a little t-shirt, have a little bit of fun. It's good when I see that kind of ticker go over and a new person has bought the shirt. A particular kind of bestseller and one that I enjoy is the Bathroom Time t-shirt, which is a reference to the Panos Cosmatos film Mandy, so check that one out. Head over to youtube.com/ Caged In Pod, where you can just subscribe to Caged In TV, which I promise like all of these things will be kind of gearing up to do more. I have just been very, very busy as of late with something else that I should plug, which is getting Defoe, where myself and Daryl Edge with a host of amazing guests are going through the career of Willem Dafoe in curated seasons of his work, inspired by the fantastic as Paul Dano O'Kay, and realizing from this here podcast that going chronologically for an actor's career can sometimes not be the greatest. So kind of having a wide swath of great, bad, and everything in between per season, it's making that quite fun, and that will be dropping. You'll be able to listen to that on the 28th of June, where you'll get not one but two episodes with our introduction as to what we know about Willem Dafoe, and our first episode, which is in his first on-screen performance in Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate. That feels like that is everything that needs to be plugged, talked about, and all of that good stuff. So if you could be so kind as to rate, review, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are listening to this right now, that would be fantastic and much appreciated. Remember to let me know what you think Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation for that to be read out on the podcast. So as always, guys, I've been Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.